We felt the platform and the thoughts were inspirational, informative, and blessed in every way. And we just thank the Lord for the abundance that He has provided for all of us. Abundance in every avenue of life, in the natural, the physical, the mental, and the spiritual, how He has been so provident in all of His provisions. And we can just glorify Him day by day for all that He has meant and all that He is doing for each and every one. But you know, it's so hard sometimes to keep that foremost and uppermost in our conscious minds. Because as the pressures and the erosion of our daily tasks occur, we so often forget the Lord's past benefits and blessings. So easy it is to just live for the moment and for the hour, and not to take the time view or the broad perspective and see how God interacts and is planning and divining and governing all of our affairs. He who has led us thus will lead us still. And I know to whom I have commended my life, that He will keep that which I have commended unto Him against that perfect day. And in the moments of exaltation, at those high moments of life in which we seem to be on the mountain peak, oh, how those feelings and sentiments and emotions just surge within us, and we feel so close to God and so close to one another. But there are those low points, those clouds of life, those valleys in which the flood seems to overwhelm, and old moments when we are caught off guard. And then we just wonder and we doubt and we sometimes question, where is God? And there is that tendency towards that human frailing and weakness, that tendency to murmur, that danger of not being grateful, that expectation of putting God to the test and requiring that God will meet our demands on our terms. And there is no greater mire in all of life than to be cast in that mold or in that frame, that mire of murmuring. There is no slimy bog or devouring quagmire or treacherous quicksand that can be more dangerous than that mental attitude or set wherein our faith has lost its command, and for an instant or a moment we get to that point of murmuring, that point of discontent, that point of self-pity and self-centeredness, that fault-finding attitude, that unwillingness to take our course of whatever may be, that lack of faith, that dissatisfaction with the way God has led and our presumption to have a better plan, that time in which the flesh is threatened or inconvenienced, and resort to that device which the flesh is immediately calling upon for its own desires, that attitude of railing against the Lord and for His provisions for us. I think the Apostle Paul was very aware, acutely aware, of that imminent danger. And you remember how in that familiar passage to the church at Corinth, in 1 Corinthians 10:6-12, now these things were our examples to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, neither be ye idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. And our key text, neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he stand take heed, lest he fall. Paul was very much aware and sensitive to the fact that these are close-girding sins. These are the sins which so heavily weigh and beset us. and which seem to be built into the very nature of the fallen man. And therefore, he says, neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. We should just like to do nothing more, dear brethren, but just simply put together those various incidents in the life of Israel, referred to here by Paul, where this murmuring occurred, and how, when seen back to back, and when seen in its full ugliness, we can see how insidious and how close girdling is this quality, and which all of us are susceptible to. When things just don't go as we would expect or we would hope, or when we are caught off balance, oh, how the flesh, in its attempt to rescue its own interests, will resort to this device of biting, as it were, the hand that fit it, and of railing against the Lord and his provisions. And nothing is more paralyzing or given to a panic reaction or leading to the disease of the spirit or result in the disorganization of our ability to cope than this attitude of murmuring against the Lord. And again we reiterate, it is so ingrained in all of us that we must be on the close lookout for its appearance, and at every indication of it, we are to resort to the power, the word, and the prayer life of the Christian. We remember that when Moses was leading Israel from Egypt, oh, perhaps they were 2.5 million souls all together, and how Moses was now, as that intrepid leader, prepared by Jehovah for this purpose for now 80 years, steeped in the wisdom of Egypt, now disciplined by the backside of the mountain in the desert areas, where for 40 years he learned obedience, and where he was now returned to Egypt for the specific purpose of carrying out this wonderful mission of freedom and independence for God's people. And you recall the very outset of that wondrous event, when after that night of the Passover, and they passed through Egypt and were confronted now by the Red Sea in the front and the mountains on the side and the Egyptian hordes hot on their heels, how when they got to that seemingly impasse, they began to question, Moses, did you bring us here now to perish, to be cut down by the sword of Pharaoh? That was the instinctive human attempt for survival. It was a panic response on their part. And we shall see all during their wilderness journey that same prevailing attitude was their native, intuitive, natural reaction. We come first then to Exodus 15:24 as one of our first early encounters with this quality. And let us see how it reacted upon the Israelites, upon Moses, and most of all upon Jehovah and his response thereto. Immediately after their miraculous deliverance, oh, the camp of Israel was in a state of excitement and exultation. Miriam takes her cymbal and she dances in this glorious, happy deliverance, triumphant song in which the entire camp joins. And as they then journeyed for 3 days in the wilderness, and they found no water, and in the 23rd verse it says, and when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. Oh yes, we recall that in this journey, they were on a journey for survival. Water and food were the basic needs. In this trackless wilderness, in this scorching heat, in an area that was formidable and forbidden, water was the most precious commodity, and each step of the way that was a prime concern. And therefore we can well imagine how this was a preoccupation, as well as solid nourishment in food. We think too, dear friends, how this is a picture of the glorious antitypical Moses that is going to take not just 2 or 3 millions to a promised land, but maybe 50 or more billions of Earth's humanity through 1,000 years of mediatorial blessing, coming to a point in which they will then come into the promised land of eternal life, where they will be serving God in spirit and in truth. And how, as Moses had his difficult experiences and trials, the Lord is now preparing a greater than Moses, an antitypical Moses, to bring about a great and glorious deliverance of all mankind. And we see the means whereby that is possible. Here we see how the waters of life, which had become polluted, the waters which were promised to give Israel life, could not give so through the law, but rather because of sin, it was needed that the ransom be provided. And that tree, picturing the work, the ransoming work of Jesus, hurled into those polluted waters, those bitter waters, sweetened with water so that there was waters of life. Jesus said to the woman at the well that he is the living waters, and whosoever would drink of those waters shall never perish. And here we see how Israel, in picture, had the assurance that the waters of life would be made available to them in God's due time. And then the next instance where we see the panic, the concern, and we see the wonderful provisions that God has made for them, his awareness, his total concern for their welfare and for their needs. We see in the 16th chapter of Exodus, that when they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, and the whole congregation of the children murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And notice the tenor and the motif of their murmuring. And the children of Israel said unto them, Would to God we had died by the hands of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. They forgot, in a matter of a few weeks, they forgot all about the more than 200 years of severe oppression. They forgot about the bricks without straw. They no longer felt the lash of the slave owner's whip. They did not know the rations on which they were subsisting. They only fantasized of now what they had left, the flesh pots and bread to the full, only concerned about the immediate, not with their vision towards the promised land to which they had gone, but rather only concerned about the here and now. And in response to this, again in his long-suffering patience with them, Moses entreats the Lord, and he assures them that there will be bread of heaven rained out for them, so that the Lord, as he says to Moses in the 4th verse, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And then you know how the provision of the manna was given to them, and how the Lord, in so giving, said he has heard the murmurings of the children of Israel, and speak to them that at even ye shall eat bread, in the morning ye shall be filled with bread, and ye shall know that I am the Lord your God. And he gave them not only the manna, but he also gave them flesh, for which they asked. And the 13th verse, And it came to pass that at even the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host. And then comes this very charming little incident with the manna, how the Lord describes the manna, gives it to them, and how they become familiar with this strange plant. They've never seen anything like it. And what is it, was their question. And manna, therefore, was its name. What is it? It was a totally unfamiliar product to them. It was small, it was round, it was white, it was sweet, it was hard, it melted in the sun, and it had a daily provision. The wafers were a flat cake that were made from manna. And as they gathered it rather painstakingly, because of being such a small grain, it required a great deal of harvesting. And they were given a specified amount. Their supply was guaranteed. There was no question as to sufficiency. And they, however, gathered it in under certain conditions. There was to be no speculation in the grain market. There was to be no hoarding. There was to be no competition. Rather, there was to be sharing equally and the like. Also, provision was made on the sixth day for a double portion so that the Sabbath could be maintained inviolate. And yet, as you might recall, there were some who would try and to test and to see whether or not they might just, quotes, beat the system, end quotes. And there were some who tried to gather in more than their share. There were some who tried to gather in from one day and keep it to the next, only to find that it putrefied. This caused Moses to be somewhat wrought. This caused the Lord to chastise them, because he had indicated to them what his purposes were, and they were to put him, to prove him, put him to the test. They'd ask for flesh. They yearned for the flesh pots of Egypt. And he did give them quail that morning and manna as well. And so assuring them that they had nothing to worry about, that he who was able to rescue them from the jaws of Pharaoh would bear them into the promised land. And the children of Israel did eat manna 40 years. Until they came into a land inhabited. They did eat manna until they came into the borders of the land of Canaan, as expressed and promised in the 35th verse. And then again we see in the very next chapter, in very rapid kaleidoscopic episodes, how the Israelites were constantly pressing the Lord and giving Moses a difficulty, because of their insistence upon some of the better things of life, not being contented with what the Lord had for them, but now always looking for an improvement in their way of living. Oh, isn't that a rather common experience? We always wish to elevate, always wish to be a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more filled, a little bit more certain about our control of our environment. And now we note that in the 17th verse, chapter, that when they pitched at Rephidim, that there again was a problem of water supply. For there seemed to be no water for the people to drink. And we note that the people did chide with Moses. Give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, why chide ye with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord? This chiding now not took the form of merely requesting, but rather almost taunting, almost ridiculing, almost a challenging of them. And the people thirst there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? And just think of this poor leader. This great man of God who was overworked and misunderstood, how he cried unto the Lord, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. So short was their temper, and so angry and hostile was their response. To be sure, Moses would not be in exclusive company. David, Jeremiah, Stephen, Paul, and the Master were either threatened by stoning or actually stoned. Little wonder, therefore, that Moses himself was subjected to this threat to his person. And the Lord said to Moses, go before the people and take that staff that you had with you when you smote the river and I saved you from Pharaoh. And behold, stand before the rock in Horeb. Smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, and the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders. And he named the place there Massa and Meribah, because of the chiding of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord. We note that Massa means temptation. Meribah is strife. Again, we see the tempers, we see the sense of desperation, we see their inability to accept the Lord and to rest upon his providential direction. Again, as we turn then to a second time in which the smiting of the rock occurred, and this was in the 20th chapter of the book of Numbers, some 38 years later, when Israel was about to enter into the portals of the Promised Land, when now at the end of this torturous period of his life, Moses was now to enter ostensibly in triumph into the Promised Land. And there it says in the 20th verse in the first chapter, then came the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, into the desert of Zin in the first month. And the people abode in Kadesh this time, not in Rephidim. And Miriam died there and was buried there. 5 months later, Aaron died. And there was no water for the congregation. And they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. Now for some 39 years, they had evidence that God was providing all of their necessities. They had the blessed assurance that he had brought them to the very threshold of the Promised Land. And now, again, let us examine their method of appeal and how they demand and how they insist. And the people showed with Moses and spake, saying, would God that we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. And why have ye brought us up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our cattle should die here? And wherefore have ye made us to come up out of Egypt to bring us into this evil place? There is no place of seed, nor of figs, nor of vines, or of pomegranates. Neither is there any water to drink. We note how they add to their demands. Now they're thinking not merely of water. That was their last item on the agenda. Now they were thinking of seed, figs, vines, pomegranates. These are some of the, shall I say, luxuries of the diet. These are the pluses. These are the additions which God did not promise them. He merely promised that he would bring them into the land of flowing with milk and honey. And Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly unto the door of the tabernacle, and they fell upon their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared unto him. Now we note, the Lord spoke to Moses, take the rod, oh, that familiar rod that was his constant companion during those years, and gather thou the assembly together, thou and Aaron thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes, and it shall give his water, and thou shalt bring forth to them out of the rock, so that thou shalt give the congregation and their beasts. Moses took the rod, and he, in his righteous indignation, in his anger, in his awareness of their lack of appreciation, in their unregenerate attitude of constant complaining and murmuring, and their insatiable infantile desire to want their immediate impulses gratified, he speaks unto the entire congregation gathered before the rock, hear ye now, ye rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand with his rod, smote the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly. And the congregation drank, and their beasts also. Ah, here was one of those faux pas, one of those fatal slips. Moses, who had been so patient, so long-suffering, so forbearing, now realizing how this rebelliousness, this utter unappreciation, so possessed these people that he said, "Must we fetch water out of this rock?" Referring to them as rebels, when God said, "Speak to the rock, and I will bring water." The presumption of Moses, in his heat of anger, in his emotional wrought-up state, and how indicative it is, dear brethren, never ought we to make decisions or to carry out important acts in a state of excitement or of high emotion. Any such effort will undoubtedly result in our misinterpreting, in our being sorry for what might be an impulsive outburst that would not really reflect our more considerate judgment. And because he reviled against the camp, and because he smote the rock twice, the Lord spake unto Moses, "Because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them." We note that this is a beautiful picture, smiting the rock, bringing the living waters from the rock as we saw at Rephidim. But here, smiting the rock twice would give another picture or type. Those who have partaken of the living water and those who smite it again as though it were a common thing, as though the life and the work and the righteousness of our Lord was no longer held by them as a wonderful means of salvation, but rather they are twice plucked up by the roots. And those, as Jude tells us, are like clouds without waters, who have lost their first love and who have now nothing to look forward to, bringing themselves out from the grace and the power of God, which is manifested only through Christ. Truly picturing those who will go into a condition of second death, those who smite the Master, who do not maintain the faith and who repudiate the blood that redeemed them. And again we see that at the very point of going into the promised land, that when the spies were sent into the land and they were coming back with the report as to the readiness of the land to be conquered, Caleb and Joshua, of course, gave forth the hopeful and the true report, how they told about the wonders of the land and how fertile and how fruitful. But the ten, fearful of their lives, they brought back a report which was not a verified one. They did not reconnoiter the land as Joshua had, and therefore brought back a distorted viewpoint. But above all, they brought back a viewpoint which ignored the providences of God. They were thinking only of their own ability and their own military prowess. And as a result, they were discouraging to the military foray into the area. And we see then that only Joshua speaks to the group and says, "Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bred for us." They're ready for the picking. Their defense is departed from them. The Lord is with us. Fear them not. But all the congregation bade them stone them with stones. And the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle, and the Lord said to Moses, "How long will this people provoke me, and how long will it be ere they believe me, for all the signs that I have showed among them?" And then he gives that wonderful proposition that now, perhaps, if they should be just taken away, and that God would make of Moses a new nation, and that the Lord is long-suffering, and is of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. And Moses intercedes for them, and the Lord pardons them because of his love for this fidelity and this earnestness of his servant. We can see also Korah's rebellion. And as Korah represented, and be mindful that Korah was a Levite, and the Levites, the very tribe from which the priesthood were to be taken, they sought to usurp control and function in the priesthood's office. And how, when God condemned them justly and the earth swallowed up those 250 rebels, we note how the rest of the people responded on the next day. It says, on the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, ye have killed the people of the Lord. And the congregation was gathered against Moses and against Aaron. And as that occurred, the Lord in his wrath did inflict upon them a plague. And as the congregation members seemed to be falling like tenpins, and as there was a mysterious plague amongst them, the Lord spoke unto Aaron and Moses, go into the congregation, bring into them the censer, and make an atonement for them, for there is wrath gone out from the Lord, and the plague has begun. And Aaron took, as Moses commanded, ran into the midst of the congregation. The plague was begun, and he put incense and made an atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stayed. And they that died were 14,700, besides the 250 that died in the matter of Korah. We see again how God's wrath, how God's patience, was beginning to manifest in more great retribution unto them. These lessons that they should have learned, they did not. And therefore, the penalty became more severe and their punishment more crucial. And then we see again how the manna was given to them and quail for 40 days, and how for those days they were given by God so as to supply all of their needs. These are just episodes in the life of Israel, episodes which somehow they could not relate and carry over from one experience to the other. That so often is a sign of immaturity and a sign of a lack of continuity of our experiences. How necessary it is for us to grow in grace and in knowledge, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little, and for us to build upon the lessons of the past. But when we are in this attitude of self-pity, and when we are complaining, expecting that the Lord is going to do for us because he has promised, and we presume upon that promise, then it gets to the point wherein the individual relinquishes responsibilities for his own behavior. And at that point, there is a spiritual, a mental breakdown. Murmuring is that attitude, therefore, which is antithetical to the new creature. And I think, friends, if we would just examine ourselves, I think we would find in many areas of life that tendency to just, with reservation, follow and to carry out our responsibilities. Oh, do we feel all the time, dear friends, when in our ecclesia arrangements, at our business meetings, that when things don't go exactly as we feel they should for the welfare of the class, and perhaps we are right in our ultimately proven right in our judgment. But when the majority of the brethren feel otherwise, and we just don't seem to prevail in our judgments, is there an attitude of, well, we'll see, or I know I'm right, or if brother so-and-so did not speak up so forcefully, he's influencing the thoughts and the opinions of others, or sister so-and-so is a little too aggressive and she ought to be more reserved in the public expression? Is not this a form of murmuring? Is this not a willingness to accept what the overruling judgment of the Lord have permitted? Oh, they may be wrong in their decision, but the permissive will of God was exercised. And for the instruction and for the learning of all concerned, we sometimes are permitted to make mistakes. If we didn't make mistakes, we would never learn from them. Isn't it so often that what we feel is our righteous and our knowledge and our understanding not prevailing, merely a reflection of our own hurt, of our own ego not being gratified, or our own judgment not being respected? Are we not murmuring, dear friends, when the Lord gives us experiences along every line, and it just doesn't go the way we would see it, and we wonder why and how? When there are moments when we doubt whether the Lord is still at the helm directing, or why it occurred in the manner it did, those are evidences, dear brethren, that the flesh is very much alive, and that this spiritual genetic code that we heard so much about is not really allowing, we're not allowing it to have its full development, and that the environment that we are building for it is not enhancing the process of growth, but rather inhibiting it, and that there will be distortions and that there will be developmental defects if we allow such an attitude to prevail. Is it not murmuring, dear friends, when we sometimes don't see as clearly in the divine word or the prophetic vision as we would like? And we sometimes in our discussions with others are impatient, and we feel that they are not upholding the message or the truth as we believe it. And we sometimes have reservations about their fidelity and their stand. Has that been one of the stigmas of the harvest period, when Brother Russell becomes such an issue that if you don't believe and understand and interpret and agree with my understanding of Brother Russell, then you're not faithful to that wise and faithful servant? Is not that a form of murmuring? Isn't that an area in which we may be setting ourselves apart and making expectations upon God which He has not indicated we are proper in doing? God will reveal His methods and His word in His own due time, and we as students of prophecy should not go ahead of Him, but rather we are to always seek what is His judgment and what is His word, and how to be students rather than writers or teachers of prophecy. This murmuring, dear friends, is such a close-girded sin that it is so built into a part of us that it is always present. And we therefore, in order to avoid the condemnation which Israel warranted, we need to always seek the judgment, the guidance, and the will of God. In his instruction to Timothy, Paul wrote that godliness with contentment is great gain. If we are observing the godliness and seeking his will and sacrificing ourselves thereto, there will come this contentment. There will come this assurance that we are seeking to serve him supremely. And that is our only objective. Everything else is secondary. All of that is subservient to the fact that we want God's will to be concerned, and we can then sing with full vigor, content whatever lot I see, since 'tis my God that leadeth me. We start every morning with the resolve And we say that my earliest thought I desire shall be, what shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits towards me? And then we catalog a long series of areas where there is need for divine supervision and direction, and where we have committed and will be alert that day to have our new creatures carry out this work of sacrificing the flesh in its interests. Then at the end, with the very epilogue, it says, I will neither murmur nor repine at what the Lord's providence may permit, because faith can firmly trust him, come what may. Do we then, dear brethren, carry that theme through every conscious moment of our day? Do we really recognize the Lord's providence working in our daily activity? That what we are doing at the moment, or saying, or thinking, has the Lord's direction and supervision? Do we have that assurance that we are seeking and that we are accepting whatsoever circumstances he permits to have its way? Have thine own way, Lord, have thy way. Thou art the potter, I am the clay. Make me and mold me after thy will while I am laying quiet and still. This is having the Lord's providence come what may. The Apostle Jude, in writing his short little epistle, one little chapter, but oh, in that chapter how condemning he is of those who take themselves out of the grace of God. Those who, by virtue of spiritual stupor, allow themselves to go into a condition of presumptiveness. That sin which David speaks of in the 19th Psalm, that sin of presumption, that would have dominion over him, and that would cause him to perform the great transgression. The transgression of taking oneself out of the grace of God by divorcing himself from the provisions of Christ, and then just having no more prospects or hope for life whatsoever. And as Jude gives us a little bit of a diagnosis or a case study of those who he has observed in this wretched condition of degeneracy and of spiritual apostasy, he puts forth some of the underlying fundamental reasons and identifies some of their characteristics which eventuates in this very unfortunate, untimely end. And he says, these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lusts, and their mouth speaketh great swelling words, having men's persons in admiration because of advantage. Murmurings, complainers, walking after their own lusts, and their mouth speaking great swelling words. Dear friends, Paul wrote that these things are written unto them for our admonition. Paul was aware of the frailties of the human frame, and he was aware of the complete battle of the new creature against the flesh. There was no quarters asked and no quarters given. And he tells us that neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he stand take heed lest he fall. May the Lord add his blessing.